are my neighbors? Tune in to Out There to meet some of them. Out There airs every Wednesday from 4 to 5 in the afternoon with me, Ruthie Woodring. Come with me and my recorder to meet people and plants and think about ways we can share the world. That's Out There every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. here on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP, 103.3 FM, Northampton. Archived editions of Out There are online at weatherbeard.com/RUTHY. Get out if you can. But if you can't get out, tune in. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm not pressing the right button here somewhere. But I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Today's show is going to be about trash and recycling and maybe waste reduction. I have an interview with Susan Waite, the solid waste coordinator for the city of Northampton. And here, we'll start with this. I'm stretching to reach this other computer. Here we go. Hey, I do a little radio show on the community radio station. I'm doing a piece on trash. I'm trying to get some quotes from trash haulers. Have you been doing just the paper route for a while? Or do you do trash too?
I do it all, yeah.
Can I just ask you, for the recorder, how it feels to haul trash day after day and to see all the trash?
I don't think too much about it. You know, I'm just trying to pay some bills, that's all I got.
Yeah. I know you're busy. I don't want to cause anything.
What I got to do to earn a living here.
All right. That was a truck driver from this morning. I'm going to start the interview with Susan.
My name is Susan Waite. I am the solid waste planner for the City of Northampton Department of Public Works. And you've been working in Amherst in the same position, right?
Yeah.
Yes, I've been their recycling and solid waste coordinator for about 9.5 years. And I just left recently and I'm now only in Northampton.
What drew you to this job? Tell me about your passion for these things.
Oh, well, I grew up in southern Arizona, and my very frugal New Englander father saved things to use, and we had a whole kind of back area with scrap pieces of lumber and stuff like that, and he was a little different from other people, other parents, in that he always tried to have a garden, even though it was difficult when it's 110 degrees outside. But he gardened, and he was a fix-it person and was a very handy, frugal kind of person. So my very first job, actually, in junior high, was vacuuming at the Buffalo Exchange in Tucson, Arizona, which was the very first Buffalo Exchange. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Yeah.
It is a second-hand clothing store. But it's a consign. Well, it's cash for clothing. It was one of the first cash for clothing organizations in the United States, really. But I started in junior high. I worked pretty much through college and out of college for the Buffalo Exchange, and it was this amazing experience. I learned about the value of discarded things, and I learned to not be grossed out by something that somebody else has worn. It's easily washed, It just was a really great growing up experience. In college, I started a curbside paper and can collection program in the neighborhood that we lived. My friend Meg Horton and I did. Mm-hmm. It was called We Can Recycle because they didn't have curbside recycling in the area, and we'd pick up on Saturdays and take it to the local recycling center. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of my reuse and recycling background. I went into training and development and human resources, and it was just, I think, when we moved here to the Western Mass from New Jersey that I started getting back into recycling. I was looking for a part-time job because my daughter was young, and this was 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine said, I know a part-time job. She said, somebody just left at the Department of Public Works in Amherst, the recycling coordinator. And she said, the superintendent said, said, how are we going to find somebody that wants a part-time job with no benefits, uh-huh. you know, doing trash? And my friend said, I think I know somebody. So that's how I got it back in. And mm-hmm. so I don't have a big educational background mm-hmm. in waste and recycling, but I do have background in adult education and training and development. Mm-hmm. So that's where I come in.
So you've been at it for around 10 years?
Around now? 10 years, and part-time.
Yep. What keeps you in it?
Oh, it is so rewarding. Trust me, it's not the money. It's not the money, and it's not the amount of respect I get out there in the world. It's funny because my husband and I, we always talk about when we were married, my husband's an astronomer, and I said, the wedding invitation said, Earthy Sue and Starry-Eyed Todd. And that's it. Still pretty much holds today. I'm the one that's grounded, and damn it, I'm in trash too.
So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about trash and refuse in Northampton.
Mm-hmm. From a commercial standpoint, it's all about what makes financial sense,
yeah.
and people don't understand. They're not as aware of the high cost of labor. And it's not just the hourly wage, it's all of their benefits, too. I mean, you can add, you know, a good $10 an hour onto what somebody makes, and that's what you're paying for their health insurance, overtime. There's just a lot of stuff. So when you add that and the gas and the wear and tear on the truck, it can add up over time. And then there's the cost of disposal. So tipping fees are what you pay to get to offload something. So compost or food waste, the tipping fees are usually quite low, whereas waste, like municipal solid waste, trash, it's much higher. Mm-hmm. And then there's also a tip fee for things like e-waste and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So everything, there's a cost. So if it's $5 cheaper or $2 cheaper or even $1 cheaper to take it to Springfield instead of Greenfield, mm-hmm. it's going to add up over time.
Yeah. Could you compare how much energy it takes mm-hmm. or resources it takes to deal with trash versus recycling versus compost?
Well, that can be complicated based on where the final end site is. As an example, we talked about the Seneca Falls landfill, which is, I believe it's 285 miles from, it was 285 miles from Amherst. So I'm not sure what it is from Northampton. And that's one way. So the tip fee is usually, for a community, is usually based on a contract that you hold with the organization. And it's often based on volume. So the more you bring, the cheaper your rate. Mm-hmm. So Massachusetts has the highest average tip fee. This was at least according to a study that was done a few years ago. It has the highest average tip fee of any state in the United States. And I think that the average tip fee was like $100 a ton. Mm-hmm. And that's average across the whole state. As I said, when you have a contract with a facility, sometimes you get a lower rate, so I'm not sure how they put that into the equation when they calculated who had the highest tip fees. But Massachusetts has high tip fees, in part because we don't have a whole lot of landfills, active landfills anymore, and there's a moratorium on increasing incineration at waste energy incineration facilities. So we're kind of really limited in how much we can process here, so we have to start looking out of state. Mm-hmm. And that's where we are going to Seneca Falls. A lot of places around here are going to Seneca Falls. So if you pay, say Seneca Falls gives you a rate of $60 a ton, mm-hmm. you have to calculate your labor expense of having your driver drive the semi, tractor, trailer, pulling the stuff to Seneca Falls, 285 miles. You have to calculate benefits for that person. You have to calculate gasoline or diesel fuel. Mm-hmm. You can calculate the carbon footprint of the exhaust. And we have in Amherst, I have some information if you want me to give it to you sometime. We have calculated that for a study that we did for landfill alternatives. And then the driver has to come back. Mm-hmm. It's going to be less because he's not going to be hauling the weight, but it still is substantial. If there is an opportunity in another state that's further afield for $30 a ton, it changes the equation significantly, mm-hmm. because you, at that point, either have to pay a driver longer, or you can put it on a train, which is going to be a lot less expensive, but then you have to have rail access. Mm-hmm. The train obviously will be less polluting, but it is still going further afield. So, mm-hmm. for instance, one of the cheapest states, the tipping fee, average tipping fee in a place like Wyoming, I think it was, or mm-hmm. Montana, you're going to die. $18 a ton.
So and when you said 100 in Massachusetts?
100. Oh. So when you look at that differential, mm-hmm. even shipping it a distance, it makes better financial sense to do that. Not economic sense or environment. I mean, not environmental sense necessarily, but mm-hmm. but it makes better economic sense in some mm-hmm. cases to do that than to bring it to Connecticut where it can be processed locally. Mm-hmm. With compost, it's a lot different because you want to process it locally. And that's one of the beautiful things about composting, because food waste tends to be really heavy. It's yeah. wet and it's heavy. It's like shipping water, which is like yeah. one of the worst things in the world. Don't yeah. buy bottled water.
And don't throw away bottled water before even emptying your bottles.
Oh, my God. I you know, when I think of shipping, I mean, and this is how the whole marketing thing and food industry has changed. I'm from the era when you had frozen concentrated orange juice and frozen concentrated punch and frozen concentrated pineapple juice, and you added your own water. Mm-hmm. And we don't do that a whole lot anymore. It's available. You can buy it in the stores, but the size in the freezer is a fraction of what it was when I was little. It's very hard to find frozen concentrated pineapple juice, for instance. So what's replaced it is concentrate mixed with water, put into bottles and sold in stores. And I think the average consumer doesn't think about what it took to make that happen and the distance that liquid probably has traveled mm-hmm. in order to save you the trouble of adding water to your concentrate. And what's ironic is that a lot of those, if you look at the label, they are from concentrate. Yeah. So they essentially took liquid concentrate and added water, bottled it, and then shipped it. Uh-huh. But anyway, so compost is, it's very heavy and it can be very, a lot of volume. Especially if it has paper products mixed in with it from a post-consumer kind of stuff. If you have napkins and paper plates mixed in with it. Mm-hmm. So you can save a lot of money by processing it locally. So not only does it produce a nutrient-rich soil amendment that is fabulous, it saves shipping, it saves, you know, it's better for the earth in the long run if it's processed appropriately. If it's processed appropriately, it's not creating the methane that it would in an enclosed landfill environment. So that's another thing that the average consumer doesn't understand. When you put organic waste in a landfill, a sanitary landfill is an enclosed, like entombed. Mm-hmm. There's a liner on the bottom, and it gets sealed on the top. And then you pump out any fluids that collect at the bottom of the landfill. Mm-hmm. So it's entombed. Your waste is being entombed. And when you put anything organic in there for the first 20 years maybe of the landfill's life, mm-hmm. as it decomposes without oxygen, and it doesn't have oxygen, it produces methane. And methane is, I don't know what the statistic is, like 10 times, 100 times worse than other forms of other greenhouse gases mm-hmm. in the long run. So composting pulls out a large part of that organic waste from the municipal waste stream mm-hmm. and allows you to process it locally mm-hmm. and turn it into a soil amendment that people actually want. Mm-hmm. So what's wrong, you know, mm-hmm. what's wrong with this picture? Yeah. Nothing.
I want to get to recycling costs, but okay. I want to go back to the methane. Mm-hmm. So when they cap a landfill, mm-hmm. they try and collect, burn off the methane. Or
right,
use it
right.
Whatever.
Depends on the size of the landfill. They either burn it off or they collect it for...
How long is it there open and uncapped with methane, producing methane?
Oh, well, it depends on the size and the landfill. Yeah. You know, big landfills that have... They're required to put on daily cover, but that doesn't prevent methane from escaping. Mm-hmm. And it's the first... first 10 years are the big methane, 10 years is the big methane period, and then 20 years, it kind of peters off after 20 years. So if you have an old landfill and you want to put a methane capture system on it, it just doesn't make a lot of sense because it's most of the methane has already escaped. Yeah.
Okay, so could you talk a little bit about the...
But I just want to say, if you don't cap a landfill... And you have all this open stuff. It also means that you, when it rains, you are adding water to the mix, which will then, I mean, you know, the liner's there and they probably pump it out, but moisture speeds up and augments the decomposition process for organics. So is that better or worse? I don't know, but it is a factor. Once it's capped, the moisture either rolls off or, you know, there's a way that they prevent the liquid from reaching the inside of the landfill. And they do testing and monitoring to make sure that the cap, they call it, is intact. But before the cap is placed, to my knowledge, there's not a whole lot of stuff they can do to prevent.
So this is Out There. This has been an interview with Susan Waite that you're listening to. We'll continue more with the interview in a little bit. One of the things I wanted to talk about, she was talking about compost, and according to the Pioneer Valley Planning Commission report on composting, Northampton wastes about 3,500 tons of food each year. This friend of mine, who's a farmer that I was talking to the other day, was telling me how demoralizing it is to know that some of the food she grows is just going to be trucked to landfills and entombed. But Smith Folk is going to begin composting again this fall at the old Burt's Pit Road site. I think they're going to start pretty small, but maybe it'll grow. Just want to give kudos to facilities manager Tim Smith and superintendent Jeffrey Peterson. And also Jonathan Goldman, a young man from Northampton who's been working on compost a lot, and he wrote a letter to the editor recently about it. And go Jonathan for all his work on it as well. Here's another little clip about trash I have. I've been trying to find some trash haulers in town that I could talk to.
Oh my God, you just like hit the jackpot.
So as trash haulers, I wonder if you could tell me, like, when you see all this waste day after day, what do you think? How is it for you?
It's stinky sometimes. Well, it also varies from, like, house to house. Like, some people you see, like, they just produce so little, like, garbage, and then other people produce so much, even though, like, it's not necessarily dependent on, like, the size of your family or how many people live in a dwelling. It's just interesting to see, like, the different patterns of, like, consumer use and waste between individuals.
I like it when people are have really organized trash. Like, yeah, like, it makes me happy about, I don't know, I'm like, I could be organized if these people's garbage can be organized. So
the more I work with trash, the less I like it. Overall, trash, recycling, compost, across the board, the more I think less waste is best.
Does it get overwhelming?
Yes, I get overwhelmed. I do. I get overwhelmed by all of the waste that all of us consume on a daily basis and produce on a daily basis.
Yeah. Has it affected how much you all produce in your homes? Do you all make trash?
Definitely make trash. But I feel like for how many people that I live with in my house, I feel like we produce a fairly light amount of trash. I live with 7 people, and I think we have like one really big bag of garbage a week, which is pretty good, I think, for 7 people. I have some like 2 or 3 person households that produce like 2 or 3 times as much trash.
Mm-hmm. Your trash probably comes from the trash to begin with anyway, doesn't
it? some of it does. Yeah, some of it does.
For me, it really, I have a lot of awareness about recycling, like how much recycling can be produced, even if you're conscious about minimal trash production. And as somebody in the waste hauling business, I'm really aware of how much energy it takes to process recycling as well as trash.
This is Ruthie from Pedal People with a public service announcement. If you frequent downtown Northampton or Florence and you pass by the recycling and trash bins on the street, the public ones, I'm here to let you know that cups are not recyclable. No plastic cups, no paper cups, no styrofoam cups, no clear cups, red cups, blue cups, yellow cups, no insulated cups. Because if you put cups in the recycling bin, it means either I pick them out or someone at the sorting facility picks them out in Springfield, or it contaminates the whole load too much that the whole load is considered trash. Or if you can just bring your own cup altogether and not have disposable cups, that'd be even better. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your cooperation. All right, we're going to go back to the interview with Susan Waite, Solid Waste Coordinator for the City of Northampton.
Could you say a few things about recycling and what happens to it and what some of the environmental costs are?
Sure. I need to make a qualifying statement and say I have my own strong feelings about recycling, and what I'm saying does not necessarily represent the opinion of the City of Northampton. Everyone's heard of the reduce, reuse, recycle, that the maximum. When that was coined, it was coined in that particular order for a reason, because mm-hmm. those three things, reducing, reusing, and recycle, are put in that order because the first ones are more, make a bigger impact on the environment than the last one. Mm-hmm. And so how does it go? Reduce, reuse, recycle. Mm-hmm. So recycling actually is wonderful, mm-hmm. but it makes more sense with some materials than others.
No. Hola, Martin!
It makes most sense to recycle certain kinds of material. And it's all about how much energy it took to originally pull it out of the earth and produce the material to begin with. Mm-hmm. So it makes far more sense to reduce the amount of material or waste that you're creating and to reuse what is already in existence than it does to recycle, because recycling has a footprint in itself. So if you can avoid creating plastic bottles that need to be recycled, that's going to make a lot more sense environmentally than recycling. Mm-hmm. That's not necessarily what the plastics industry and mm-hmm. various other industries want you to think. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them have come out very strongly in support of recycling. Mm-hmm. You know, so they're promoting recycling. Keep America Beautiful is an organization uh-huh. that receives lots of money from corporations to promote recycling. And recycling is good, but it's not a panacea for the consumption that we have in the United States.
Promoting recycling is just promoting consumption.
Exactly. Because guess what? It means the bottling companies can keep bottling. It means the aluminum can industry, you know, can keep producing aluminum cans, all of that. So it makes most sense from what I understand, and I'm not an expert, but it makes the most sense to recycle materials like aluminum mm-hmm. that require a really labor-intensive process to produce the aluminum. Aluminum is produced from bauxite ore, and bauxite ore needs to be extracted and processed, and there's some nasty chemicals involved. I don't know if you recall, somewhere in Eastern Europe, I think, there was a toxic red sludge spill in a community. I want to say Hungary or something like that. Turkey, and this red sludge from a nearby factory inundated this community, and it was from a bauxite processing facility that was mm-hmm. turning bauxite ore into aluminum. And so, you know, there's some nasty things that go on to produce it, and it's a valuable resource, it's a valuable metal, so it makes a lot of sense to recycle it. Mm-hmm. Something like plastic, on the other hand, it's good to recycle, but only if you're going to save energy at some level. Uh-huh. And this is where my personal feelings about expanded polystyrene come into play. Mm-hmm. Because plastic is made, it's a petroleum product, so we have to drill, and then the petroleum has to get shipped around. And then there's some chemical processes that happen to it. But it's not quite as intensive process to produce something like styrofoam as it is to produce aluminum. Mm-hmm. So it's very easy and very inexpensive to produce mm-hmm. expanded polystyrene. So to
spend the energy collecting it, shipping it around, recycling it, and then using it again, mm-hmm. doesn't make a lot of sense unless it's of great value. Mm-hmm. And because it's still so inexpensive to produce the new stuff, there isn't a big market out there for used stuff. There is a market. It's an emerging market. It's a growing market. But it's not a huge market. In addition, food waste and oil residue are considered a contaminant. So that's why it's not great to recycle used food-related EPS or styrofoam. And, you know, people say, well, I can wash it. Well, then you're using drinkable water to wash some stuff that doesn't even have a lot of value to begin with. So there, you know, there are certain things that make great amount of sense. I think aluminum and steel makes a great amount of sense. And some plastics are highly sought after. HDPE and PET plastics, you know, there's a really strong market for. Mm-hmm. Other plastics. Milk jugs are number two. That's HDPE, and PET tend to be water bottles. Mm-hmm. So there is a good market for water bottles. The carpeting industry and the polar fleece industry are happy to buy those. Mm-hmm. But, you know, recycling is complicated because there's kind of two camps when it comes to recycling education. The first camp is tell people all the details and tell them what they want to know. Mm-hmm. And the other camp says, well, you know what, we don't want to overwhelm people and turn people off, so mm-hmm. let's just give them what they need to know and we'll figure out the rest. Mm-hmm. So when you're deciding what to put into your curbside bin, the simple story is you put bottles, cans, tubs, jars, plastic and glass, and steel and aluminum, bottles, cans, tubs, jars, and plastic lids. If they're small, they need to be affixed to the bottles. So that's the easy answer. But when you come down to it, it's a little more complicated, because even two items that have a number one resin identification on them, they're produced in totally different ways. And you can have blow molding, which is how a water bottle is made, and they essentially blow air and blow the resin into the mold with air. And there's also injection molding. And with injection molding, they have to add chemicals to the resin in order to be able to inject it into the mold. So now it's no longer a pure resin. Mm-hmm. It's got some chemicals in it. And what happened was, originally, you know, those clear clamshells that you get deli food in and mm-hmm. stuff like that. Originally, our local recycling facility in Springfield couldn't take those, didn't want them, because they didn't have a buyer for them. Mm-hmm. They say a number one on them, which is supposedly a very marketable resin. And everyone said, well, you know, if they want the bottles, surely they want this. Well, they didn't, because the carpeting industry, which was their major buyer of the material, and when you make carpet out of PET plastic with these chemicals in it, you get big blobs of goo in your carpet because of the chemical reaction with the heat or, you know, something like that. Something in their manufacturing process did not go well with the added chemicals. So they only want bottles. So the MRF in Springfield had to try to find somebody who was willing to take the number one plastic with the chemicals. So, mm-hmm. so, you know, there's just a lot of complexity to the whole recycling thing that the average person out there that's recycling doesn't understand. The other numbers of plastic, if they don't have a market for them in the U.S. mm-hmm. or even locally, might get packed up and shipped to China, where, you know, we don't know what they do with them necessarily. Mm-hmm. You know, you kind of lose control at that point.
So a lot of people are curious about the numbers of the chasing arrows.
Yeah.
Why would a number one? Why aren't all number ones the same? What are the numbers?
Well, they
mean?
Are. They are. Okay. That system. This is another thing that most people don't have no idea about. The untold story of recycling. Mm-hmm. That whole system was created by the plastics industry. There's a industry group called the American Chemistry Council that's kind of a lobbying professional organization for the plastics industry and a couple other industries as well.
And during, I think, the 1970s, they, or maybe into the 80s, they developed this resin identification system. And they, at the time, chose to use the Chasing Arrows as part of the system branding. And so nobody was monitoring that, and I think there still isn't a monitoring organization for the Chasing Arrows. But that's probably the single most confusing thing for every person out there who's ever tried or thought about recycling, and because they see the Chasing Arrows and they assume that it's recyclable or is recycled. Mm-hmm. And you can argue that anything is recyclable, mm-hmm. but it's not going to get recycled if there isn't a market for it or if it doesn't make economic sense to recycle it. Mm-hmm. So everybody, you know, sees the Chasing Arrow on a number 6, for instance, and says, see, it's recyclable. Mm-hmm. You know, this is going to get recycled. Well, not necessarily. You know, it depends on the demand of the resin and how expensive it is to produce new and if it makes economic sense to recycle it. So number 6 is polystyrene, which is the same material that styrofoam is made out of. There's polystyrene, and then there's expanded polystyrene, which is essentially blowing bubbles into the polystyrene. And that's what makes the insulating effect of styrofoam. So styrofoam is bulky and has insulating properties that can be very handy. But polystyrene in general, and I'm not up on the latest and greatest, but in general, the market is still emerging. It's not a really fabulous market out there for it. Mm-hmm. But that's not what the people want you to think. So, just to step back a couple steps, the whole bottle bill update that was attempted, the argument that the bottling companies promoted was that we already have a recycling system in place, so why would you want to put a deposit on the bottle? We have already got everything covered, essentially, so why go the extra step? Mm-hmm. And, you know, what they don't talk about is that, yes, the recycling is in place, but people aren't using it. Mm-hmm. And there's something about a financial incentive that makes people recycle more. I mean, the facts were something like, I don't know, I think 10% or less mm-hmm. of the bottles that you have used beverage bottles are actually recycled.
The ones that don't have deposits.
The ones that don't have deposits, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the ones that do have deposits.
It's different. Oh, it was something like, I don't know, it's 60 to 80% or yeah. something like that. So it makes a huge difference, but that's not what they focused on. They focused on it's unnecessary and it's a tax for you. You know, it's essentially a tax and it's unnecessary because we already have recycling systems in place. And so that was the message that they spent millions and millions of dollars getting out to public in Massachusetts.
Okay. I wonder if you could talk about what it'll take to stop or slow the flow of trash. Mm-hmm. Man, you talked about fear early on, how yeah. fear isn't helpful.
It's true that fear tactics tend to make people stick their head in the sand, and they have defense mechanisms that just kind of help them ignore the situation. So what usually works is education, and from what I've read, one of the biggest thing that works is keeping up with the Joneses, mm-hmm. comparing people to their neighbors.
Oh,
so
yeah.
if you notice, energy companies yeah, are yeah. now producing reports about what your energy consumption is based on your neighbors, mm-hmm. and it's very effective. Mm-hmm. You know, people are like, hey, what's he doing that I should be doing, mm-hmm. you know? And that's a motivating force mm-hmm. in the United States is to how you stack up against others.
Petal People talked about doing that with our customers, but I don't think we got it together. We should try. We yeah. should do that. I think we have all the data.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the things I love, I just need to say, people who hire Petal People, it seems like, are really owning their trash. I mean, you are physically moving it somewhere, powered by the people, mm-hmm. to get rid of it. And there's a kind of primal responsibility involved with that. It's different if you are moving it by animal or by truck. Mm. Just think if everybody had to carry their own waste yeah. to the site where yeah. it was going to be taken care of. Think about that. Talk about motivating force for reducing waste. That would be fabulous.
I want to go back to one thing you said about Petal People, which is that we often only haul it, you know, the first 1 or 2, maybe 3 miles out mm-hmm. of
288 miles.
It's more than a lot of people are doing. Yeah. You know, however small piece of owning their waste, it makes you feel the waste that we're producing. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it makes you guys feel it more than the people producing it. But that might be a motivating force for producing less waste. Mm-hmm. But I think that there are two big pieces to me about waste reduction. And one is for consumers to be more aware of single-use items and to reduce, remember, reduce, reuse, mm-hmm. recycle, mm-hmm. To reduce and reuse as much as humanly possible. Mm-hmm. Bottled water can be very convenient in some situations, and I have no problem with it in some situations, but this is my personal opinion. You don't need to buy cases of bottled water. You know, if you don't like the taste of your tap water, get a really good filter system. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a fraction of the cost. Mm-hmm. Fraction of the cost. So you can reduce the number of bottles that you're generating by not buying as many, not using as many, and reuse what you can. So if you have a spaghetti sauce jar that's glass, but it's a mason jar or a, you know, obviously reusable one, you know, keep it and use it as a to store food in, soup in, drink, use it as a glass, use it as a vase. You know, we got to start reusing more. And that's where the Recenter comes in, if I may do an unsolicited plug. reuse more as much as you can, and then start thinking about recycling. Where, so the other piece, so I said there were two pieces. The other piece is that I personally feel that the producers need to take more of a personal responsibility in the disposal of their products and materials. And that's where producer responsibility or expanded producer responsibility and product stewardship comes in. Mm-hmm. And in some countries, I think in Japan, I think companies are required to have disposal options for their own products. Mm-hmm. Something like that. I need to do a little research on that. But I read that and I was like, that is so cool. So uh-huh. some countries are further ahead of us. In Europe, if you notice going into the drugstore or the pharmacy, whatever they call it, they're toothpaste tubes don't have boxes. They're just tubes. They don't have all the heavy packaging that we have. And that's in part because of more producer responsibility legislation. And because they don't have the land that we do. So they've already run out of space. And they don't want to have to incinerate more than they have to. So I think that there's a whole piece of that where the manufacturers need to step up. And that's a long road to hoe. So probably your personal responsibility is probably the biggest thing that we can do right now. Not to say that we shouldn't push for that. And that's where the citizen muscle thing comes in. There's an organization called The Story of Stuff. If you haven't watched the Story of Stuff video, it's on YouTube. And you can also go to thestoryofstuff.org. And they have a number of films, but their title film, The Story of Stuff, is fabulous and helps you understand what consumption in the United States and in the world, what effects it has. But they have a special program called Exercising Your Citizen Muscle. And I believe it's completely free. It's a course that you sign up for that educates people about how to stand up for things that they feel need to happen and that gives people some tools to use and information to make them feel more confident stepping up and voicing what they feel need to happen. And she talks about exercising your citizen muscle, and I think that's a really big piece of what people can do. Mm-hmm. You might not be able to get the plastics industry to voluntarily, mm-hmm. you know, put a deposit on water bottles, but you can pick away at some of their policies and strategies that don't make sense in your own legal way.
Yeah, I think that's about it. Unless there's anything else you want to say.
Oh, there's love.
Oh, yeah. I think your time's not up.
You're entitled. You're entitled to my opinion.
Thank you.
It's been fun. Thanks.
So you've been listening to an interview with Susan Waite, solid waste coordinator for the city of Northampton. This is Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ LP 103.3 FM, Northampton, and streaming online at valleyfreeradio.org. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. So, where does the trash and recycling and compost from Northampton go? Well, it depends who hauls it, because each trucking company decides for themselves. One of the things I just said when I was talking with Susan is that Pedal People just hauls the trash for the first few miles of its 280-mile journey to the landfill. But actually, currently, the trash from the city of Northampton, from the Locust Street Transfer Center, it's being trucked to the Chicopee landfill. But I've heard that might close in a year or two. The trash from other haulers in Northampton, it might go to the incinerator in Covanta in Springfield, or it might go to the K&W sorting facility in West Springfield as its first stop. Or like Susan said, it might go 280-some miles to the Seneca Falls landfill in upstate New York. I believe that's where the stuff from the Amherst Transfer Center is going. And as far as recycling, well, I think the recycling from the Locust Street Transfer Center is going to the MRF in Springfield, the sorting facility in Springfield. ARS is taking some of their paper, maybe all of the paper, I'm not sure, to the Sunoco place in Holyoke. It's a paper mill or paper recycling place. There's also a single stream MRF on the east side of Springfield that some recycling is going to for sorting. And where else? I think I mentioned the K&W site in West Springfield for sorting. And as far as organics, currently the organics from the Northampton Transfer Center, I think right now they're going to Hadley. They were going to Belchertown. This is also sites in this Martin's Farms up in Greenfield. But even the organics typically stays a little bit closer. But anything we can do to keep it in our own yards or what, the closer the better. All right, what's next? I actually have a few more minutes of the interview with Susan talking about the Enterprise Fund and how funding works for trash and recycling related things. But before I get to that, I just wanted to mention a few other shows on Valley Free Radio. Coming up after Out There at 5 o'clock is Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. That airs every weekday from 5 to 6. And on Sundays, you might hear a recording from Edwards Church, or the service from Edwards Church, from 1 to 2 p.m. on Sundays. Also, Sunday afternoons from 4 to 6 is a music show called Sing About It. All right, so here's a little bit more from Susan talking about the funding.
Tied into that, it's kind of like who pays for recycling and who should pay for recycling or for reducing trash. Like with the bottle bill, when the beverage industry made that argument. Another thing is, like, people are paying, like taxpayers are paying for these recycling programs, whereas with the bottle bill, wouldn't some of the...
Well, yeah, the taxpayers aren't necessarily paying for the recycling programs. It depends on how their solid waste system is funded. So, Northampton and Amherst have their funding from a solid waste enterprise fund, which means that it is pretty much separated from the tax base. That means that your property taxes are not going to pay for solid waste services. Enterprise fund, and I'm not an expert on this either, but an enterprise fund essentially is a self-fund. It's a separate fund that is self-supporting from the tax base. So that means there has to be an income for it. And most places with solid waste enterprise funds used to have active landfills. Mm-hmm. And that was the source of the income into the solid waste enterprise fund. Mm-hmm. So from that income, you could then support a whole bunch of solid waste services. Mm-hmm. People don't realize how much, you know, a landfill is a cash cow, but it's also a long-term expense. But you could make tons and tons and tons and tons of money when it's active. But then you have to pay for the, you know, for 100 plus years to monitor it and take mm-hmm. care of it. Mm-hmm. So the problem with enterprise funds and landfills is that when landfills close for whatever reason, you then have cut off your major income stream for the fund, and you have to find other ways to fund solid waste services. And they can be pretty substantial in cost, so to suddenly tack them on to the tax base is not a popular thing, and people try to avoid doing that at all costs. So when you have a system like that, where you aren't paying tax money for the solid waste services, mm-hmm. unless you have a big income stream, you're not going to have a city-driven garbage pickup, trash pickup, and recycling pickup. In most communities, so once the income stream is gone, you have to figure out what's going to pay for these services, mm-hmm. and finding the money in the tax base is a really tough sell.
But most communities, I mean, everywhere I ever lived before I came to Western mm-hmm. Massachusetts, there was municipal trash pickup. It's just people are already used
because
to paying.
They're used to paying, and it's already part of the budget. It's part of the whole municipal budget system. Yeah. It's not, I mean, it is part of the budget system, but it's not from the tax income. And other communities that have that generally are paid for out of the property tax base. Mm-hmm. So it's a major shift yeah. in cost. So in Northampton, our landfill is closed. So the transfer stations are operated. We have landfill monitoring expenses. All these things now have to find some source of income. And in Amherst, our landfill closed about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. So we're further along with what Northampton is going to be experiencing, mm-hmm. which is it's hard to keep a solid waste enterprise fund going. I mean, yeah, it's an enterprise fund, by definition, is self-supporting. It can't be in the red. It can't run in the red. You either have to close down the whole enterprise fund and move everything into the tax base, which is... Mm-hmm. not a popular thing to do, or you need to find some other source of income. In Amherst, Guilford has been looking for other sources of income. Cell tower. Yeah, he's the superintendent. So they're building a cell tower out there. Mm-hmm. He did try to get a solar array placed on the old landfill. We have two landfills in Amherst. And there was a company really interested in placing a solar array on the older landfill. It perfect aspect and slope for a solar array, mm-hmm. but that the kibosh was put on that by a number of neighbor groups. It's close to an affluent neighborhood, and they kind of like their grassy meadow. But if you can find some income to help support the services, then you're fine. If you can't, then you have to start looking at cutting services or moving stuff over to the property tax base. And in Amherst, they've cut services, and that's where it stands right now.
So that's been an interview with Susan Waite, Solid Waste Coordinator for the City of Northampton. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ 103.3. Before the hour is up, I have another little clip from the Florence Community Gardens, or the FOG, the Florence Organic Gardens. But first I'm going to mention a few things going on around town. The Northampton Committee to Stop War 2015 Summer Film Series is showing The Heist on August 24th. The Heist looks at the question, who stole the American dream? And invites some answers as to how we can get it back. That's at Forbes Library in Northampton, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. on August 24th. According to the calendar, that looks like a Monday. Also, Casa Latina is seeking energetic individuals to serve on the board of directors. The mission of Casa Latina Incorporated is a nonprofit organization serving Hampshire County that's committed to promoting Latino empowerment and cultural pride through providing services, developing educational spaces, and facilitating individual and collective action for social change among members of the Latino community. And if you're interested in being on the board of directors, interest or experience in any of the following areas is helpful: fundraising and grant writing, community organizing, social justice, health access, education, legal support, and political advocacy. The board meets once a month for 2 hours in their Florence office at 115 Pine Street. If you're interested, you can email them at casalatina@conversent.net, conversent.net, or call Lillian at 413-586-1569. One more announcement.
I found a boy today. It looks so good. Why did you throw it away?
You want to learn to fix your bike? How to keep it tuned up so it's there for you when you need it? Or maybe you know already, but you just need to borrow a bike-specific tool that you don't have. Well, come to the Bike Lab.
Almost every Saturday since 2004, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., here in Northampton at 12 Northern Avenue.
Come with your bike or your questions.
And your willing attitude.
Spare parts scavenger hunt every weekend.
Venga para el Bike Lab de Northampton y se divertirá mucho, le enseñará muchas lecciones como arreglar bicicletas.
All repairs guaranteed to the end of the driveway.
Details are online at pedalpeople.coop. That's the Saturday Bike Lab at 12 Northern Avenue,
11 a.m. to 2 p.m.
They say freedom isn't free, but at the Bike Lab it is.
Ya súbase a la bici, compa. Trépese a la de montaña, la bici urbana, la bici cross. Lléguele a la bicicleta. Ya de menos a la eléctrica o a la estática, ya no hay tos. Llegaré pedaleando en el viaje de allá para acá.
All right, so the next clip I have here is from a day at the Florence Community Gardens. Just a few people I ran into that were there when I was tending my plot.
What are you doing at the garden out here today?
We're picking some onions. And what else are we doing, Joe? We gotta pick our...
I fell on this orange thing and I hurt myself.
Yeah. That's true. We tripped and we skinned our knee.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're gonna pick some cherry gold tomatoes. Gotta lay down some compost. Pull up some weeds. Then we're gonna get out of the sun. That's our plan.
Can I ask you what you like about the garden?
It's proximity to home for me. What's your favorite part of the garden?
That it has so much dirt.
I wonder if you could just introduce yourself and tell me what you're doing at the garden today, what your role is.
Yeah, my name is Riley, and...
I'm Danielle.
And today, well, I guess for the past, like, several weeks throughout the summer, we've been doing a lot of work on the Giving Garden, which is a plot where we're growing squash, zucchini, beets, turnips,
tomatoes,
peppers.
Yeah.
And all of the produce goes to the Survival Center and the soup kitchens in Northampton.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you all are interns with Grow Food Northampton?
Yep. We're both Smith students. Yeah. And we're interning for the summer.
What kinds of things does your job entail besides the Giving Garden?
We've also been working with Susan at the Herb CSA, mostly just like as farmhands doing weeding and whatever she needs us to do. We built a hoop house over there. What?
From Sawmill Farm?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. What are our other jobs? Just like upkeep in the community gardens. We've been putting signs up and those kinds of things.
How do you like it?
It's awesome.
I like it a lot.
It's nice being outside. Very happy to not have a desk job this summer. Need to be inside all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a really wonderful place to spend hours and hours every week.
Mm-hmm. So. Do you know if there are available plots?
Definitely for next summer there will be new plots open for people interested in gardening here.
And so the Florence Organic Gardens, Florence Community Gardens, also called the FOG, they're in Florence down on Meadow Street in the corner of Meadow Street and Spring Street. A beautiful place to be. So on last week's show, one of the things that I mentioned was the Tiny Dance performance. They were the Tiny Dance troupe was doing shows traveling by bicycle with their stage on one of the bike trailers, and they were doing shows around Northampton. They had a bunch of them, one that was on the bike path by my house. And I wanted to record some of it to maybe play, but I only got about 15 seconds worth. They sang as they danced.
We can bring to birth a new from the ashes of the old. For the movement, it makes us stronger.
So they were singing and dancing at the same time, and there it was really great. To close out, I have a little bit of piano music. I was going through downtown. I think it was last Thursday night. I think it's a Thursday thing, because I think I saw a flyer today that said that there is music at Sam's Pizza, and Cafe on Main Street across from Pulaski Park. There's a piano in there, and sometimes people play it, and it just floats out onto the street.